Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting, broadcasting, broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world, to the world, to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. It is November 5th, and today's topic is, what in the heck are they testing for? Excuse me. Well, we know doctors do a lot of testing, and we know that there's a lot of harm going on. So what's up? In order to get a good look at this and understand what's going on, it's always nice to start at the beginning. So let's start at the beginning. What is a test? Well, a test, this is a dictionary definition. As you will find, this is a medical definition, but dictionary definition is, test is something designed to get information from you. This information then guides the doctor's therapy. That's the medical definition. Now, Webster's Dictionary says, it's a procedure for critical evaluation, a means of determining the presence, quality, or truth of something. Now, this is interesting. As it relates to a doctor's visit, what the doctor's really doing with a test is determining the truth of what you're telling him and determining the truth of what his examining hands tell him. So the test is actually designed to determine, to get information, to determine the quality or truth of something. Now, a synonym is a trial. Now, the thing to understand about trial and about test is it's not real. So it's not real. So a formal examination of evidence before a judge, and the evidence, of course, is the test result, and the judge is embodied, let's say, in the physician, and typically before a jury in order to decide guilt, and guilt meaning, do you have a disease, you know, do you have AIDS, do you have prostate cancer, do you have a disease, is your body guilty? And this is actually absolutely true. In other words, any test is only giving you information about your body already has. This is important to understand. So the test can't tell you anything that your subconscious and your body does not already know. So next, the meaning of the test, its interpretation, is totally arbitrary and in the hands of the doctor. So the words the doctor says and the predictions he gives you based on a test are arbitrary. Although, you know, we're trained to accept this as etched in stone and absolutely accurate. Now, the doctor's predictions are totally dictated by the standard of care, which is written by insurance companies, drug companies, and hospitals. So whoever writes the standard of care is the person or the individual or the institution that's really interpreting your test results. And this test is designed to get you to submit to another test, which would be torture and great expense. Or to submit to mutilation, that would be a biopsy, or even worse, major surgery. So the results of that initial mutilation, say biopsy, are then designed so that you'll need more mutilation, call it surgery, and more tests as a result of that. So where's the proof? Dr. Daniels, that's some pretty harsh stuff. So where's the proof for all this? Okay, here's some proof. For every dollar, first of all, doctor does a test, whether it's a blood pressure test, whether it's a blood sugar test, gets a result. On the basis of these results, the doctor will recommend a drug. For every dollar in medication, a doctor prescribes $3 of additional care or medical consumption or torture, however you look at that, is needed to treat the side effects of the drug he recommends. So the end game for any test is to get you to do another test or submit and take a drug, or the ultimate, of course, is mutilation and surgery. Now, the doctor is instructed to tell you that you must take the initial drug for the rest of your life. And the doctor is also told that you must not stop any medication because medications are life-saving. Well, wait a minute. How could a medication possibly be life-saving when you were alive, when you walked into the doctor's office and you were not taking the medication? Doesn't add up, does it? So let's take another look. So it's not well understood about what is being tested. So each test, as I said, gets information from your body by means of force, like a needle prick. Not exactly a peaceful way of getting information. So a needle prick, as in a blood test. Physical force, as in the compression of your breast during a mammogram. Even the intrusive physical exam involving pressing and poking. If this happened in a different context, say, a stranger coming up to you on the street demanding you take off your clothes and touching and pressing your body all over, you might more easily recognize this as assault. And actually, in medical school, we were told that what we were doing to people's bodies was assault. How about that? They actually told us that touching people in the way we were being instructed to touch people was assault, punishable by any court of law, except the difference, the government gave doctors special permission, as license, to assault people in this way because it was actually helping people. So even with the person's consent, it would be assault, if not for the healing nature of the touching. And this is why doctors have the special government permission. So in medical school, we were actually told that the type of touching we were engaging in when we touched a patient was actually a form of assault. And only because the information we gleaned was going to be used to benefit the patient was this assault justified. Very interesting. So the next question becomes, why test? Like, why bother? Well, many patients believe that the reason for a test is to make a diagnosis. What if I told you that you could extract this information yourself? What if I told you that the test only extracts information you already have? So tests to the doctor are as the chicken entrails are to the witch doctor. In other words, to get your cooperation, the witch doctor says, it's not just my opinion. I have objective proof. The chicken entrails, they're right here. They say so. You've got to give me your money, and you've got to take this awful-tasting brew I have sitting in the corner here. Now, with the doctor says, it's not just me. The test results say you're sick. Never mind you feel fine. The test results say you're sick. It is exactly the same thing. There's really no difference. Now, 90% of those diagnosed with breast cancer, this is an example, do not have a life-shortening disease. How is it that 30% of breast cancer victims die of breast cancer? Answer, the treatment must have killed 20%. This presumes a cure rate of therapy of 0%. If we concede that chemotherapy is effective, let's say it's 100% effective, chemotherapy, radiation, mastectomy, 100% effective, total cure. Then the 30% of women who died of breast cancer must have been the 30% who never had it and who actually died of the chemotherapy. Interesting, isn't it? Of course, you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor. Murder by Medicine is no accident. This incredible Kindle book is available at Amazon.com and, of course, Kindle format. This is Dr. Daniels' book, that's me, that has laid bare the deadly machinery of the medical industrial complex. Get your copy and share with your loved ones. This book could save your life, so you no longer have to fear death by medicine. So always, I welcome your calls and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695, and I'll take questions at the end of the program. Now, back to our program. Okay, so we've got these tests. How are normal ranges for tests determined? So how do you know what a normal range is? Well, tests are designed to indicate that 5 out of 100 healthy people have a disease when they really do not have a disease. How do you like them apples? That is incredible. So this is considered, by the way, a very good test, one that that only labels 5 out of 100 healthy people as actually having disease when they don't. So if you give a test to a healthy population, 5% will demonstrate disease. Now, if you only do the test on people who are sick, you will get the same 5% false positive rate. But the positive test is unrelated to the person's symptoms, their diagnosis, or their likelihood of benefiting from the proposed therapy. This is the crux of the fraud. So because the person has symptoms, he willingly accepts the false association between his symptoms and the test results, and the equally false conclusion that what the doctor is about to propose will benefit him. Now, you say, Dr. Daniels, like, how can we even believe such a thing? Well, we can infer that this is the case because 89% of what doctors do is ineffective. Yet, 95% of therapy they recommend is based on tests, an x-ray, a blood test, or physical exam. So an excellent example of this is cardiac catheterization and the need for coronary artery bypass surgery or stent. This is a common thing that happens. A cardiac cath shows a vessel that is 95% occluded and two that are totally blocked. You would think this indicates that the person is hanging on a thread by a thread and needs the open heart surgery to restore the blood supply to his heart. This is absolutely false, and you've fallen prey to the very false logic that the medical profession would hope you would engage in. It turns out that the test indicates the person's body has created alternative pathways to supply blood to the heart. Therefore, even though the test is not normal, it does not indicate the need for the proposed intervention or suggest that the patient will benefit from the intervention. This means that no matter what the test shows, the proposed therapy simply is not effective for the illness the patient has. So the test is merely a marketing tool to convince the patient that he needs to part with his money and his health, or things will get worse. This is no different, again, from reading chicken entrails to determine the future and what purchase should be made next. The meaning of the entrails is, of course, related to the chicken they came from and has nothing to do with the condition of the human that is looking at them. This is obvious to any fool. Somehow, this relationship is obscured when people are educated to believe in science but not told that science has nothing to do with the medical tests. Now, how do you convince someone who is perfectly healthy to accept deadly therapy? Well, the test. So how are the tests calibrated to come out with this, to make this happen? Let's take a look at hypertension. That's a good one. Now, I happen to be pretty old, so I can tell you what happened in medical school a very long time ago, dark ages, that'd be 1979, year of our Lord. Way back then, we were told that 140 over 90 is high blood pressure. Anything less than 140 over 90 is normal. So we've got a test, the blood pressure test. Take a person's blood pressure. Again, the degree of assault is fairly minor, just a little squeeze of the arm. And so 140 over 90 is our break point. And this gives us a certain percent of Americans that have hypertension. Well, patients accepted the high blood pressure label so well that the calibrations are adjusted. So now, anything more than 120 over 80 is a form of hypertension. Presto, 33% of adult Americans are now diseased. Did you catch that? Were you listening? With the stroke of a pencil, just by changing your normal blood pressure from 140 over 90 to 120 over 80, we've now created 33% of Americans in a disease category called hypertension. Now, mind you, there's no evidence that treatment of any blood pressure extends life. Yes, the person may not die of a heart attack or a stroke because, of course, the blood pressure has been lowered, right? But guess what? The blood pressure has been lowered so much that many vital organs are not getting the blood that they need. And the person then dies of the complication of their medication. So the time of death is about the same. No evidence that it extends life. And so what they've done now, is I just got to tell you, normal is 120 over 80. Then they have pre-hypertension, which is between 120 and 139, over anything between 80 and 89. Then there's high blood pressure stage 1, 140 to 159, or 90 to 99. And stage 2, which is anything more than 160 on the top. Now, we got all this sliced up to obscure this, the very fact that we have now created a new disease group called prehypertension, and there's not any indication that therapy in that group is of any benefit whatever. In fact, therapy in that group, the 120 to 139 group, actually increases mortality tremendously. So still the recommendation is drugs at the 140 over 90 mark and up, and between 120 and 130, see your doctor as frequently as he asks you to so he can keep an eye on this. Now, diabetes is another excellent example. We now have pre-diabetes, which is a reading of 101 to 135. This expands the treatment group, expands the opportunity for medical intervention or the intervention of the doctor, but in no way improves life expectancy because, of course, the condition did not shorten life expectancy. So you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor. Murder by Medicine is no accident. This is available at Amazon.com in Kindle format. And Dr. Daniels' book has laid bare the deadly machinery of the medical industrial complex. Get your copy and share with your loved ones. This book could save your life and your family. You no longer have to fear death by medicine. As always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Of course, I'll take questions at the end of the program. Now, back to our program. Okay, so let's take a look at the process. Your typical office visit. It goes like this. Patient comes in and he says, "Doctor, I do not feel well." And the doctor says, "Well, I do not find anything on exam. Let's do some tests." And the patient says, "Okay." This is the green light the doctor needs. And the doctor orders tests and says, "Well, these tests are normal." And the patient says, foolishly, "Doctor, I still do not feel well. It must be something. Find it." The doctor says, "Okay, let's do more tests." Now, the patient does not realize that he is now in the false positive territory. The doctor told him it was nothing. And he said, "Doctor, please lie to me." The doctor says, "Well, okay." And so the next test involves a larger volume of blood, more torture, stronger radiation, more harm. And the radiologist sees a spot over here. That's it, on your liver. Ah, here it is, the false positive. There it comes. So now, of course, the doctor sends the patient for a liver biopsy. This test has serious complications that include death. So the patient gets a liver biopsy. He gets heavy, profuse bleeding. It's a complication. An infection, and dies. Now, This experience was at least a $20,000 to $50,000 revenue-generating experience for the medical industrial complex, all because of a false positive test, in this case, the x-ray showing a spot in the liver. I call it the old spot in the liver trick. Don't fall for that one. I can't tell you how many people have spots in their livers and are doing very, very nicely, thank you. And this is one of those soft false positives that the doctor will tell you, oh my God, we have to investigate this. It could be cancer. It could be this. It could be that. If he's a really good salesman, he'll go for the liver biopsy. If he's not, he'll talk you into coming back and getting an even more expensive x-ray 1 to 3 months in the future. So now, if the slightly miserable person had just stayed home, they would be alive, and their immune system would have handled it. But they had insurance, and there you go. So how do they get these tests? You know, something has to happen to make a test, to create a test, because there's new tests all the time, right? So let's take a look at how a test becomes used, or how the interpretation is decided upon and how this turns out. My favorite test is the NMR. You probably don't recognize those letters, but I'll spell it out for you. Nuclear Magnetic Resonance Scan. I was there at ground zero, so to speak, when it was being developed back in 1980. Year of our Lord, the nuclear magnetic resonance machine was hauled out, was installed, was actually right there at the medical school I attended. So first, patients were scared by the term nuclear, so had to change the name. Very important, first thing, change the name to MRI. Probably recognize that one, magnetic resonance imaging. This is to put patients at ease and eliminate bothersome questions about the word nuclear in the name. Same scan, but different name, and actually it's worked very well. It's a very well-accepted test. So back there in 1980, x-rays were in wide use, and CAT scans were really just taking off. Now, I was in medical school, and the NMR, or the MRI machine, was introduced. I was excited. This is why I went to an Ivy League medical school. I would get the early information and be ahead of my peers who went to lesser schools. Whoa! This was my chance to learn all about it. And, of course, I asked, how could I learn more? How could I learn how to read these incredible pictures? Was there a course on reading those great pictures? And the answer absolutely shocked me, and it should also shock you. And if you're getting MRI scans, it should actually upset you. But this is the answer they gave me. They said there was no course because they did not know how to interpret the pictures. The multi-million dollar machine was manufactured, was being sold to hospitals, and nobody knew how to interpret the pictures. Why, yes, well, how do you know what the pictures mean? How will you know? They said, well, whenever there's an x-ray taken, we'll take an MRI. And after a while, we will know which pictures on MRI match which pictures on x-ray. When we take an MRI in a sick person, we'll know that MRI is not normal, you see. And eventually, we will get a catalog of what normal pictures are and what disease pictures look like. There are two things very wrong with this picture. First of all, the technology was developed. The price was probably set at $2,000 back then for each x-ray picture or MRI picture. And the machine sold with no evidence that it would make any contribution whatever to the quality of care patients got or their outcomes. That's number one. The first thing is that patient benefit in no way guided the technology, which flabbergasted me. Of course, I was going to medical school so I could go back to the ghetto and help people get better, right? So here we have this very expensive technology created just because it was expensive and just because hospitals believed they could bill at least $2,000 per picture and make a profit. And because the insurance mechanisms of the day were such that charges were paid at that time without much question. So the second bothersome thing is a new technology was being evaluated using the old technology as a gold standard. This means that the new technology could not possibly add anything to the clinical picture because it's being calibrated off of the old technology. So magnetic resonance imaging is a test that uses magnetic field and pulses of radio wave energy. Those of you who are into this whole grounding stuff, you can already see the problems here. Radio frequency signal, and so your body is put into a very strong electromagnetic field or magnetic field. These strong magnets created by running electricity through these coils. Then you are pulsed with electromagnetic radiation, basically radio waves, and structures inside the body become visible once this radio frequency current is applied. And the theory is it makes the water molecules twist around in a certain configuration and vibrate and align themselves. Now, MRI, this is according to the radiology sites, ProMRI says MRI also may show problems that cannot be seen with other imaging methods. Whoa, wait a minute, back up. We know the other imaging methods have a high false positive rate in the area of 5 to 10%. And we know that a lot of times they see things that are not there. So if the MRI can show problems not seen with other imaging methods, that means it must have a higher false positive rate. And sure enough, it does. So the MRI has a higher false positive rate than technology it would replace. Let's take a look at mammograms. I decided, well, let me take a look and see what I find. So if you look at mammograms, there's a 13% false positive rate in MRIs used to detect breast cancer. And only 0.65% get cancer. So what does that mean? It means that there are 20 unnecessary biopsies for every one cancer that's found. At a cost of $11,500 per x-ray, and those are 2011 figures, it takes $1.5 million in x-rays to find one breast cancer and $340,000 in biopsy costs. That's pretty cool. Mammograms only have a 10% false positive rate, not a 13% false positive rate, and they don't cost nearly as much. So, double the mutilation rate, certified test. Now, a thinking FDA, thinking about the patient, would not approve a test that's going to double your mutilation rate and increase your expense and increase your false positive, but it's been approved, of course. Now, as if that's not enough, that you would think that would be enough, but it's not. Sometimes, which is a lot of times, contrast material is used during the MRI, and this can cause, of course, life-threatening allergic reactions. And you'd say, well, that's pretty awful. But you know what? There's even more complications. If you have any metal in your body, say metal fillings, metal clips, tattoos with metal-based paint, any of that, then any and all of those things can become projectiles and damage and harm you during the MRI x-ray. So this is really a fair amount of, this is an excellent example, the MRI, of a test which is done that increases false positives, increases mutilation, and increases life-threatening experiences. So what's the point? Why do an MRI? Now, you can do MRI of the head, looking for brain cancers, ear problems, optic nerve problems, strokes. You can check out the chest, looking for coronary blood vessels, the heart, lung issues, breast issues. You can do an MRI of the abdomen and pelvis, looking at the organs like the liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and kidneys. Or you can do the bones and joints, looking for arthritis, bone tumors, cartilage, ligaments, or tendons, spinal stenosis, or blood vessels. You can check the arteries, see if there's a problem there. Now, this brings us to our question. Actually, someone emailed in a very nice question about MRIs. So here's the MRI question. Is there a percentage of blockage where one should consider a stent? This would be at the navel. Blockage is 50%. There's a percent of blockage or length of blockage in the thigh where one should consider a bypass. And, of course, you'd really like to clear this issue without surgery. And at what point do you say surgery is the only recourse? Okay. This is a very interesting question. First of all, The blockage is 50%. I've seen blockages of 100%. And what she's talking about is the lower aorta. So the blockage, because she said it's in the thigh, we can guess it's on one side or another. Okay. So let's just say the blockage is in the, as the aorta splits, one femoral artery goes to each leg. So this blockage is apparently in one femoral artery in the thigh. It's 50%. So if it's 50%, then the answer to that is any symptoms she's having are not attributable to the 50% blockage in that thigh. I've seen blockages of 100% in people who have fully functional legs. And it's common to see a blockage of 100% after trauma, like, say, a car accident. And so because the blockage is 50%, it's pretty certain that the blockage has nothing to do with any loss of function beyond the blockage, because 50% of the blood is getting through, and that's enough to generally maintain 100% function in the limb that you're talking about. And the one case I'm familiar with, it's an elderly lady, 76 years old, and she had a non-healing ulcer on her lower leg. And so she went to the wound clinic, and the wound clinic said, oh, my gosh, you don't have circulation, this ulcer. That's why it won't heal. So they did a test, a vascular test, and found out she had 100% occlusion in that one leg. Now, the ulcer, to be fair, was 1.5 centimeters. Well, 1.5 centimeters in diameter is one ulcer, and she had a second ulcer, 1 centimeter in diameter. A centimeter is 1/2 inch, just for anyone who wants to know. And so a ulcer that small can't really be laid totally to circulation problem. So I said, look, why don't you just clean out your circulation a little more, you know, detox a bit, have a few more bowel movements, you know, drink a little more water. Of course, my favorite cure is turpentine. Take some turpentine. And she says, no, I don't want to do that. My doctor says this. My doctor says that. So finally, when the doctor explained to her the surgery involved and how major it was going to be, of course, he used minimizing words, she says, well, maybe I'll try a cleansing. So she did. She tried the cleansing, and guess what? The ulcers healed up. 70-something-year-old lady. And this is now 3 years later, and the ulcers have not come back. So the question is this person having symptoms? If they're not having symptoms, absolutely don't even touch it. For Christ's sake, go enjoy your good life. If you are having symptoms, whatever the symptoms are not attributable to a 50% block. Generally, you need at least a 75% block before you get symptoms beyond the blockage. In other words, symptoms attributable to the blockage. All right, so I hope that helps. Okay, so the MRI scan, again, is being used as a reason to do surgery, the next piece of mutilation and torture. And as I mentioned before, if it didn't do damage, it wouldn't be a good test. MRIs can also cause tissue heat. And these frequencies, these radio frequencies, are now being used to destroy unwanted liver tissue. Heat it up, destroy it, bake it, cook it. So this is, while it is portrayed as a totally healthy and easy exam, it's not exactly. And, of course, any metal object implanted in your body can become a missile and fly around your body and harm you. So there's a fair amount of deception around tests. Tests are unreliable and unable to detect direct therapy in a manner that would heal the individual, and that would be, of course, you. And so they are designed instead to convince the hapless mark or victim or patsy to part with his fortune and his life. So a less lethal approach is seeking healing from an unlicensed individual. This is so, so important because anyone who's not licensed is not hampered by the state. In other words, they're not compelled to stick to the standard of care. There are not lies that they're obligated to tell. They may lie to you, but they're not obligated by law to lie to you. So there's a chance you might get the truth. Even better yet is a neighbor or friend, a relative, who's had a similar situation and solved it. See who they saw or just do what they did. someone who wants to see you get better and has nothing to sell you. That's like really, really cool. So that's your first resort. So your first resort is friends or relatives. Say, hey, you know what? I got this thing here. Oh, it's this, it's that, it's whatever. Did you have the same thing? Anything you do help? That's your first step. Then your second step is somebody that you might pay, and that person definitely, it's important they not be licensed, because if they are licensed, then they have to do what the government wants them to and tell them only what the government wants you to know. Now let's take a look at some other tests. I had a whole list of tests here for you. So let's start with the complete blood count. I like that one. The complete blood count is an amazing test. Now this tests your white cells, your red cells, and it tells you what the condition of your blood would be. Now this is really cool because this test is absolutely calibrated on the 95% error rate. In other words, I'm sorry, 5% error rate. So 5% of all blood tests, complete blood count, and all it tests for is a simple anemia or an abnormality in white blood cells. It's designed so that 5% of people who have this test will show up as having disease when actually there is no detectable disease. So what happens? First, you get the CBC. Fair enough. You can pick this up at a regular doctor's visit. And then at the doctor's visit, the doctor says, hey, you have anemia. Let's do another test. So now you have another piece of torture, another needle in your body. And maybe because you're anemic, now we have to see, do an iron level, total iron binding capacity, and maybe these don't show up anything, and then you have to go to the bone marrow biopsy. You never know, it might be leukemia. And at this point, each test has impaired the immune system. And so it's the kind of thing where if you keep looking, you're going to find something, even if it's not there. So the CBC is a test that's commonly done as a screening test, and one that definitely should not be done. So let's take a look at another test. Sometimes when platelets are high, people are tested, say, for leukemia. And a platelet test is a common test that comes up on the CBC. And platelets are amazing. Platelets can be anywhere from 30,000 to a million, and the person can live. Of course, the normal range is, 100,000, 200,000. Now, a lot of times, people are advised to get biopsies and tests, but platelet values can fluctuate wildly. And so if you have a high platelet value, definitely a reason for hydration. And personally, I would not investigate the platelets any further. What I would do is instead investigate if you're on any medications that cause abnormal platelets. I've had people contact me about these things, and in every case, I've been able to locate the drug they're taking that caused the platelet abnormality. So that's really important, is to look at the drugs that you are taking now or have been taking in the past. I say in the past, I mean the past 2 years. Because some drugs have long-lasting effects. You may only take the drug for, say, a week or 2 weeks or a month, and the drug can still affect you for a long period of time. So I actually have another person wrote in this question. So if you have platelets that are high, should you look for leukemia, or basically would you be better off living a life without knowing that you have cancer so as to not be put under the stress of deciding what to do? All right. We're all adults here. There is no such thing as a stress of deciding what to do. you need to decide what to do. And the decision not to make a not to take a test is actually a pretty good decision. And when you say stress of deciding what to do, I think what you might be referring to is the coercion and the pressure the medical industrial complex can place on you to accept therapy that you just don't want. So I would say if you have an abnormal platelet test, the thing to do is look for the drugs that are causing it. If you can't find drugs that are causing it, then look for the chemicals in your food that are causing it. If you can't find the chemicals in your food that are causing it, then look for the chemicals in your personal care products that might be causing it. And wherever you find that platelet factor, that is where you exert your efforts by removing that poison, removing that chemical. I hope that's helpful. Okay. Mammograms. Someone wrote in a question about mammograms. Actually, those of you who are listening, if you have questions, you can click the question thing, and I'll take questions now as well. Mammograms, I personally don't see a reason to get mammograms. I have personally never had a mammogram. But mammograms and breast biopsies combined incorrectly predict cancer in 90% of cases where cancer is predicted. So if you have a cancer proven positive by a screening mammogram and a biopsy, there's a 90% chance that what you have is not a life-shortening condition. So for this reason, getting a mammogram doesn't really make sense. And if 90% of people diagnosed in this manner don't actually have cancer, but 30% die from the disease that they don't have, then that is a problem. That's a serious red flag that getting a mammogram puts you into a category that it actually increases your risk of death. So since we're trying to get healthy here, not trying to get sick, then that's a serious no-no. All right, let's take a look at another test, colonoscopy. Oh, this is very interesting. Now, colonoscopy, for those of you who don't know, is a test for colon cancer. And in this test, a Roto-Rooter, which is a long, fat tube, is put up the rectum into the colon, goes up, around, and down all the way to the other side, basically 6 feet into the body. Pretty invasive test, if you ask me. Modern medicine has improved this by giving people the option of general anesthesia and sedation. And the risks, though, are phenomenal. The cost is $6,000 to $20,000 per colonoscopy, depending on where you get it done. And it's believed that 70,000 patients a year, that's a lot of people, get perforations, bleeding, and endoscopes for colonoscopy are not cleaned between patients. They're not sterilized. So at least 15% of them, they've been tested, harbor infectious organisms from the prior patient. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you had sex with the prior guy, you wouldn't pick up all the stuff that's on the colonoscope. It's incredible. And so just the spreading of these 15% filthy colonoscopes can cause more death than colon cancer itself. And so what's a person to do? First of all, sigmoidoscopy, which only goes 12 inches into the body, is just as effective in improving clinical outcome. And sigmoidoscopies nowadays are much more advanced. When I say advanced, I mean they're disposable. So there's a disposable tip on it. You can do a rigid sigmoidoscopy or a flexible sigmoidoscopy. And if you do it every 10 years, supposedly that's a benefit. Now, you can do an occult blood where you take your blood, your stool, smear it on a card, send it in the mail to wherever, and they test it for blood. Problem with that is high false positive rate. It's a digital rectal exam. Problem with that is a high false negative rate. And I think the whole colon cancer screening is misguided. The real question is, how do you not get colon cancer in the first place? And the answer is have regular bowel movements. So if you can poop 3 or more times a day, I know it's controversial, not everyone wants to do this. Who wants to spend time in the bathroom? But the truth of the matter is, if you clean yourself out, then what you're going to find is nothing's going to stay in there long enough to give you cancer. So that's the real deal. All right, we have a question here. Let me see if I can... Yes, I did it. Okay, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Is the turpentine therapy in your book, and how does one get your book if they don't do Amazon and they don't do Kindle?
Email support at vitalitycapsules.com.
Okay.
Gabriel will hook you up.
I have another question. If one has cramping because of this biggest, latest thing that's out there is peripheral artery disease, and if one has difficulty walking, will the turpentine therapy help them?
Okay. All right. So one question is, so we have a diagnosis, peripheral artery disease.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing modern medicine, then you can't have a diagnosis without a test. So let's just say you had a test. There are a lot of tests for peripheral artery disease. One test is a dye study, which actually makes peripheral artery disease worse. I would say if you think you might have peripheral artery disease, you can just reach your hand down there and press and see if you have a pulse. That's the acid test. Does turpentine help? Yes, it does. Should you start with turpentine? No, you shouldn't. If you have peripheral artery disease, you've got a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff in the artery. And the first place to start is with your diet. And you can shoot that little inquiry over to vitalitycapsules.com, support at vitalitycapsules.com, and they'll help you out with that. And that's Gabriel. She's, really nice. Everybody likes her, and she'll help you out. Okay, next test, prostate screening test. I've covered this before, but people have asked about it, so I'm going to mention it again. Okay, so prostate screening test, what can they tell you? This is really sad. So a prostate-specific antigen is a test. It's a screening test. And again, what's the purpose of the screening test? Screening purpose of the PSA test is to convince you that you need another test, and that's exactly what it does. So you get the PSA done, and then you say, oh, my God, it's up. That's what your doctor says. Well, you don't want to just leave that alone, do you? Then he'll do a digital rectal exam. And truth of the matter is, a digital rectal exam is irrelevant. Even if he doesn't find anything, the cancer could be further inside the prostate where his finger can't feel it. So there's really no point to a digital rectal exam in terms of prostate, except for the doctor to, assault you, violate you, and make you submissive. So that's basically a digital rectal exam. Then next, of course, you have the ultrasound. They stick something else up your butt, bounce sound waves off your prostate gland. And then, of course, there's the biopsy. God's sakes, don't do the biopsy. Biopsy penetrates the skin, transmits infections into the prostate, and creates long-term problems, even death, from resistant organisms. So what's the deal with prostate cancer? So we've got this stepwise thing, the PSA, which is just a blood test. All right, then you have a digital rectal exam, which is invasive, pressing and pushing, and even humiliating. Then you have the ultrasound, another sodomizing experience, putting something else up the rectum. Again, more submission. Then you have the biopsy. Now you have mutilation and harm. Then, of course, you have the implantation of radioactive seeds, or you can have the surgical resection or whatever. But where's all this going? Well, it turns out that if you have prostate cancer and you do nothing, then your 5-year mortality due to prostate cancer is 0%. If you have prostate cancer and you have intervention, everything your doctor recommends, then your 5-year death rate due to prostate cancer, again, is 0%. And what they do is they do not count deaths due to anything other than prostate cancer. This means that the deaths due to complications of therapy don't get counted. And, of course, another numbers trick. So should you get tested for prostate cancer? Probably not. Okay, next question, HIV testing. This is interesting. All right, I've done a whole show on HIV, but I'll just give the short story here. Okay, so HIV testing. HIV is human immunodeficiency virus, and AIDS is acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Okay, so your immune system becomes bad or fails after you were born. So it's not bad at birth. It became bad later. That's acquired. So you've got an acquired immune deficiency. Okay. So people can have an acquired immune deficiency without being HIV positive. And people can be HIV positive and not have acquired immune deficiency disease. So you can have one without the other. So there is no cause and effect relationship there. And so the other thing is the tests are not reliable, which means same test, same person, multiple times, different results. So these tests do not reliably indicate anything. And that's why it's only used in high-risk groups. And a questionnaire is used to help interpret results. This is why the person in the lab assigns the diagnosis to the targeted social group. If the person is in a high-risk group, the ambiguous test result is indicative of disease, and the test result is read as positive. The person is in a low-risk group, the ambiguous test indicates no disease. You might as well just fill out a questionnaire and skip the test. Nothing scientific there. So in other words, a test is designed to convince people that they need to take medications costing $30,000 or more a month. That's all. That's the whole story. And so since people have been indoctrinated into the concept of risk factors, they are ready to accept this label and cooperate with it. And, you know, there will always be rashes that come and go, fevers that come and go, opportunistic infections, but there's no evidence that a positive HIV test is associated with any of the features of AIDS. AIDS, as I said, stands for the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Many causes, malnutrition, toxic chemicals, but there's no evidence that any virus is the cause. Okay, another question. I just had a urine analysis with microscopic test results are as follows. Protein, 1+, this is not normal. Leukocytes, 3+, this is not normal. White blood cells, 15, this is not normal, but it's consistent with the leukocytes, which are also white blood cell counts. And so what should they do? Should they be concerned? Okay, first of all, any abnormal urine test is immediately a symptom of dehydration, so the answer is immediately drink more water. In this case, there's white blood cells, so there probably is an infection. I'm guessing this person is not pregnant. So if a person is pregnant, though, and has a urine test, doing the urine test means, okay, I've done the urine test, I'm going to start antibiotics just in case. And then, of course, you wait for the urine test to come back, and you've already sold 3 days at least worth of antibiotics. If you're not pregnant and you have symptoms, and say the urine is normal, they treat anyway. So the urine test is an excuse. Now, this test is not normal, and so what the doctor would do is offer another drug, which would lead to side effects and the need for even more drugs. And almost any abnormal urine test, whether it's urinary infection, stones, kidney disease, the answer is fluids, a little bit of salt, and let's say it's an infection, then the doctor would start like trimethoprim sulfa, which I've seen cause fibromyalgia, or Cipro, which causes tendon damage. But the alternatives, which are far more effective, would be something like D-mannose, cranberries. I like raw cranberries. It's so hard to get reasonable cranberry juice that I would just say get the raw cranberries and put them through the juicer. And even baking soda and vinegar is helpful. All right, next test, next question, Lyme disease, the Lyme test. This is shocking. I was actually going to devote a whole hour just to Lyme disease. But let me see here. This is so incredible. Okay, so this person says, how is it that with a Lyme test, a positive can mean negative, and a negative can be positive? A couple of years ago, I was positive. After a year and a half on antibiotics and no end in sight, I gave up. Fast forward over 2 years, I now believe that all I had was a serious case of candida and still do. Why the hoax of Lyme disease? Why can't doctors see these so-called diseases for what they really are? And this is from Carol, who's frustrated with candida and with Lyme testing. All right, Carol. Well, Carol, congratulations. You definitely saw through it, and that's good. So what's the deal here? First of all, doctors are not allowed to see through anything. They have a standard of care protocol. They're obligated to follow it, and that's pretty much the long and the short of it. Not complicated. A monkey could do it. So it's a very mechanical thing, being a doctor. The only stress is figuring out if you're going to follow the hospital protocol, the pharmacy protocol, or the insurance company protocol. And that just depends on who's paying you. So if the drug company is giving you a lot of dinners and office equipment, follow their protocol. If the hospital is giving you a lot of operating room time, follow their protocol. If the insurance company is threatening to not pay you, follow their protocol. And so which protocol do you follow? Often these protocols conflict. And so that's the stress of being a doctor. But let's take a look at these tests. It's FDA-approved method that attempts to identify, okay, first of all, 3.4 million Lyme tests are performed every year. And they're performed using an FDA-approved method that identifies the disease by looking at antibodies. This is important. That means at no point is any attempt made to isolate the organism that causes Lyme disease. None of these tests isolate the organism. Makes you wonder, does it exist? And if it does, there's no evidence it's present because the tests used to diagnose Lyme disease do not detect the Bordetella organism, spirochete itself. Okay, so what's the deal here? So the FDA has approved this test, and the antibody test, it's imperfect. A patient can test negative and be infected, and the body can and they can test positive long after the infection is gone. So there is no correlation between the test and the person's infection status. And the tests that are used are the ELISA test and the Western blot test. This should sound familiar. These are the exact same tests used to diagnose AIDS, an imaginary illness. So there is no provision to detect the infectious agent, the putative or the accusatory infectious agent with Lyme disease. And so for this reason, whether you have Lyme or not is indeterminate, cannot be determined by any test because none of the tests test for the presence of the spirochete Bordetella. Now, they only use antibody tests, and these cross-react with syphilis, glandular fever, or rheumatoid arthritis. And so you might actually have syphilis, but guess what? If the doctor thinks you have Lyme disease and these tests come back positive, they don't treat you for syphilis, do they? No. Remember the Tuskegee experiment a long time ago? They had these black guys who had syphilis, and they had them come back to the doctor to get checked, and what they were really doing was monitoring the long-term effects of untreated syphilis. Well, guess what? Guess what the result of that experiment was, and I think is that a lot of people have syphilis and they're not getting treated. They're being told, oh, you have Lyme, oh, you have HIV, oh, you have this, oh, you have that. And the tests used to diagnose these vague and distressing symptoms are ones that cross-react with syphilis. And so syphilis is actually going undiagnosed, my opinion. I would say it's unscientific, but here it is. It's borne out by science in that the antibody test cross-reacts with syphilis. So all I can say to this person is you're absolutely right that you don't have Lyme because the tests aren't capable of detecting it anyway. So, and here we have the American Academy of Family Practice website, and they say patients with no symptoms for Lyme should not be tested because of the high false positive rate. Wait a minute. If there's a high false positive rate in those without symptoms, isn't it also a high false positive rate in those with symptoms? Of course it is. So we have time for one more question. Let me... Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Daniels. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I have a question regarding hormones and menopause, premenopause.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What can be done to balance those? I'm doing the Candida protocol, which I've probably had Candida for 25 years, and nothing has worked like this is. So is this connected to having the Candida, or is there something else I can do to help bring my hormones more into balance? There's definitely cyclic changes that I notice that are very hard.
You mean with your cycle?
Yes.
Okay, got it. All right, I'll give you your answer off the air. Okay, this is very interesting. First of all, there's something called perimenopause. What's that? That means women are having hot flashes, they're having incredible disturbances, maybe emotional disturbances with their cycle. This is all being blamed on hormones. It's in my experience, this has almost nothing to do with hormones. In other words, I've helped people with this and not had to bother with their hormones. So what's really going on is the liver is clogged up because it's the liver's job to make all the hormones you need in the event that your ovaries are not making hormones. So it's your liver's job to, oh, there's too much get rid of that. Oh, there's too little, make some more and put it in the blood. So it's a primary liver failure issue. And so with the candida intervention, you're getting rid of the candida, which is clogging up and congesting your liver. And so what I would say is go back over the, you know, hydration, clean food, and it's real important to go have clean food, because what you we thought was clean 10 years ago, we now know it might be GMO, it might have pesticides in it we didn't know about. So there's all kinds of stuff. And then with the meats, maybe the meats are being fed antibiotics. So you really have to go back and do a very thorough look through at your diet. So make sure you're drinking enough. Make absolutely sure you're pooping enough. You know, three times a day might not be enough. Maybe you do three times a day and do an enema even. And I think you'll see what you perceive to be your hormones balancing down, your symptoms going away. So that would be the thing to do. This idea of blaming these symptoms, these irregular periods, heavy periods, painful periods, mood swings, hot flashes on hormones is, again, another marketing ploy. Again, that's been my modest experience. So what are they really testing for? They're testing for gullibility, your degree of belief, your willingness to accept torture, your willingness to accept mutilation, your willingness to participate in your own murder, and your desire for approval and your desire to please. That's what tests are for. That's all they're testing for. They'll do a test. Great. Whoa, she took that real well. Let's give her another test. Oh, wow, good. Okay, another test. Whoa, whoop, time for mutilation. That is the sequence, and that is exactly what's happening. So what should you do? Do not take any tests. It's difficult to exercise your right to religious refusal once you've bowed down at the altar. So refuse the next test, whatever it might be. Agreeing to submit to a test, waiting for the results, is a test of your interest and suitability for torture. Taking a test authorizes the medical industrial complex to track you down and compel you to submit to expensive care that the test indicates is necessary. How do I know this? Hey, I have practiced medicine as a doctor. We're told an abnormal test result, man, you got to find that patient and offer them care. And lately, it's not offer, it's even compel them to take care. So based on the test results, the doctor gets to declare a life-threatening emergency and activate the police powers of the state to intervene for your safety. So don't do it. And as the nation moves closer to government insurance, this becomes even more dangerous. And the best bet is to avoid testing. So what do you do instead? I think you should do a body scan. That's my favorite thing. It's very cheap. In other words, it costs zero. It takes about 15 seconds. It's better if you stand up, close your eyes, focus your attention on your feet, and then allow your attention to move up your leg, to your knees, to your hips. And I always say do both sides at the same time. What you're going to notice is the energy is going to drag somewhere. Maybe it's going to drag at your calf on one side, or at your hip, or in your tummy, or in your head. But wherever your attention is stuck and won't move any further, that's where the problem is. And so just doing a simple body scan, and if you do the body scan every day, just once, it's only like, you know, if you're really slow, it might take you 30 seconds. That will help you head off problems before they even occur. So that's a body scan. What do you do if you find a problem? Start simple. Increase your water, increase your bowel movements, clean up your food, and get more sleep. Usually it's all it takes. But if you ignore it, then it can go on to become, you know, something else or something more serious. Then what else can you do? So you've got your body scan. If you want to do a test, do a urine test. Why? Because your body is going to piss away the urine anyway. Your body didn't need the urine. So urine tests are okay. And you can go to the drugstore, and they actually sell urine strips. You can dip the strips in your urine, and it'll tell you all kinds of stuff. And if you don't know how to interpret it, you can either go to support@vitalitycapsules.com, and Gabriel will sign you up for, you know, a discovery session, or you know, you can go online and try and figure it out, which is very frustrating. But a lot of times, even the back of the can will tell you. So urine tests are fine. You can look at your tongue, stick your tongue out, look at it in the mirror. And now you can even go online and Google and say, what does my tongue look like? And find a tongue that looks like your tongue, read the description. It'll tell you all about it. So all these tests that we're trained to accept are just, they're not for our own good. So next week, what's up for next week? Next week is deadly drug trials. This is another secret of the drug companies, that actually a lot of people die during drug trials. And India, of all places, has stood up for the rights of its citizens, and it has laid bare the whole drug testing process. And so I'm going to share that with you next week, which is going to be why new drugs are deadly, how we know they're deadly, the harm of even being in a drug trial, and what we can do instead, of course, naturally. And that is it for today's show. We'll see you next week. And, of course, email your questions, so I will answer them on the air.